Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jacob Shockey. He's a human, father, and husband. He works primarily with beavers and people, focusing on the restoration of complex natural processes and relationships that create and maintain resilient habitat and its wildlife. Jacob co-founded and leads Project Beaver, a nonprofit dedicated to empowering humans to partner with beavers and value their works. He also sings to himself, loves flying kites, and can't spell. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. Second, thank you for being in the program.
Thank you for having me. I'm grateful to be here.
So what is Project Beaver?
So Project Beaver is a little nonprofit organization. And frankly, we're just trying to be helpful in the world to both beavers and people. I helped start it, I think it was March of 2020. So right in the middle of pandemic time, left the job that I had at the time, working to restore salmon habitat, to start this organization. And I came to that decision from my work in the restoration world. For more than a decade, I was taking big chunks of public money and trying to build fish habitat. And you know, frankly, we're doing this all across the Pacific Northwest and Northern Hemisphere, and a lot of that work isn't working. And so I came to beavers because I was spending, you know, $250,000 here and there, trying to construct salmon habitat, and meanwhile beavers are doing it for free, and they're building these beautiful verdant wetlands that, you know, my projects don't hold a candle to. And and yet they often get trapped out for silly things. You know, they'll plug a culvert in somebody's driveway and or flood some infrastructure. And so there's these human conflicts that then end up in the beavers being removed from the landscape. You know, you see these beautiful wetlands dry back up. And so it was, for me, a shift in focus to an older complex process, really realizing that we need to have the humility to look at what beavers are doing. And if we really want fish habitat or more water on the land or fire resiliency, beavers have been managing our waterways for a really long time. And so kind of deference to that wisdom. So Project Beaver is an organization just trying to find those points where we can be most helpful in helping folks who are struggling with beaver issues, and helping folks who are trying to see more beavers on the landscape where they're working. It's been a fun thing to start an organization and with the goal of being useful to beavers.
Can you back up for a second? When you were saying that a lot of the restoration work you were doing was not succeeding, can you talk about how, you know, I don't know, use a specific project or just talk in general about how a restoration project can fail?
Yeah. So to be clear, it wasn't just my projects too. I was kind of doing the projects per the best available thinking on it, and others across the landscape. You know, I remember having a conversation with someone who was pretty high up in one of the flashy environmental organizations doing a lot of restoration work, millions of dollars. And I was asking her, you know, after we were at one of these social gatherings with a bunch of biologists, and I was asking her, you know, are you seeing success? Because I'm not seeing it. My projects just aren't, they're not vital. They're not living. And she's like, you know, I am not either. And if you spend too much time thinking about it, you'll get depressed. And you got to realize this is just a job and move on. Like, that's the only way to stay sane. And there is kind of a defeatist mentality. I mean, the restoration world, I've heard it called like a restoration industrial complex. It's generating a lot of jobs and people are doing a lot of good stuff, but there's not a lot of tolerance for kind of self-examination and criticism. And there's been a kind of a ragtag group of folk who have been doing that and kind of advancing a new idea around restoration that is, instead of building habitat, like going out and finding some place that looks healthy and saying, okay, well, you know, here's the ratio of maples to ash. And so we're going to plant that. And here's what the topography looks like. So we're going to use big bulldozers and scrape the land to look like that first. And here's the fact that there's no non-native plants. And so we're going to poison all the non-native plants at this other site first. They've kind of turned that its head and said, what's the process that's missing? And can we restore that process? So rather than building the thing we want to see, can we restore the process that results then down the road in healthy habitat? And that's been a big change. So a lot of my projects and the projects of others for a long time have been building facsimiles of habitat, building what we see as humans when we go out and measure stuff, and then we watch it all fail because there's no underlying natural process that keeps that going, right? I think it's useful to think of, habitat is very similar to the word habit, right? And in a sense, habitat is the product of the habits of nature. And so if you can go in and help tweak the habits that are resulting in, you know, what that habitat looks like right now, then there's going to be a downstream ripple through the various forms of life that are on that landscape. And so I think that's also where beavers enter into the conversation, because beavers have been managing waterways. They've been in charge of our waterways in the Northern Hemisphere for millions of years, Europe and North America. Of course, everything that needs water in this landscape co-evolved with beavers in control. And so they expect a beaver-managed waterway. That's the habitat that their lineage comes from. And so, in the last 150 years here where I live, or 350 years on the other side of the coast, people have been enacting our version of what a waterway should look like. And it involves like a single channel that ribbons across the landscape and doesn't have too many things sticking in it. And it's little wonder that we see a crash in all the life that relies on waterways, because we've constructed a new version of a waterway that isn't the habitat that those animals have known. So I think that was the big shift for me, really, is you can't come in as the human and construct something and expect it to function past, you know, it'll look good as long as you have a budget for herbicide or weed whackers and, going in and trimming it up to make it continue to look like habitat. But as soon as the people absent themselves, these projects often kind of fall apart again. So that's the key difference, I think. But there's still a lot of kind of event-based restoration going on. There's still a lot of money professing to be doing good for the landscape, but we're just kind of building things that then we abandon.
Do you mind if I pursue this a bit longer before we go back to beavers?
Go for it.
So I live, where I live is on 40 acres of third growth redwood. And when my mom and I moved here 24 years ago, it had been cut, say, 24 years before that. And we haven't done any. Some guy came in and said, look, you got a lot of dog hair. Those are thin trees too close together. You need to cut a bunch of those. And we're like, nah, let nature do it. And we didn't do anything. And the place is recovering beautifully. And I've had a lot of conversations with Michael Kellett and some others on the East Coast who, I never can remember the word for it, but they don't promote reforestation. I don't remember the word for it, but basically it involves just letting the forest alone and maybe making, you know, minor changes, like if it's, well, not minor changes, but maybe making tweaks, like if there's a major predator missing, helping to reintroduce them, or as you said, with beavers. But for the most part, and I think this is the reason I'm hitting this so hard, is because it's so important to me to recognize that the forest knows better what it needs than we know what it needs. Mm-hmm. And so it just seems to me like a lot of restoration work should just be leave it alone.
Yeah, I found myself...
Again, there's exceptions, because there are times when it's so damaged it needs some help. But anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, totally. No, there are exceptions. And I think I found myself being less and less sure the more and more I learn, which, you know, I know is a cliche, but for instance, I'm looking out my window at a pasture that used to be, you know, heavy cattle use for the last 100 years. And there's all these rose and blackberry bushes that are kind of sprouting up all around it now. And I think both of those species are classified as invasive. You know, this is a escaped rootstock rose. It's not the native Nootka rose. And yet, rather than going and, you know, mowing and burning those out, we've left them. And what I've noticed is, okay, then the ground squirrels, that's cover from the red tails. And so the ground squirrels are under there building their burrows. And then they're forgetting acorns under there and pooping a lot. And so it becomes fertile and there's cover. And then the oaks, which were cut off of this landscape, start sprouting, and they have protection from deer browse because they've got this thorny bush all around them. And not only that, they go straight up because they're looking for the light. So you suddenly, you know, I look at oaks trying to regenerate where there isn't the cover of a thorny bush and they're stunted by heavy deer browse constantly. And, you know, it's 20 years and they're thigh high. And then I'll see these 5-year-old oak trees poking out of the top of a 6 or 7 foot tall blackberry patch. And they've just shot straight up and they're up in the sun and they escape deer browse and they've got roots and, you know, fertile squirrel fertilized ground. And I think, yeah, there's some wisdom there that we need to be careful just going in and messing with stuff, you know? And so I think, you know, with forests, I remember reading a quote, David Thompson, this fellow who was coming through in the late 1700s, and he wrote of North America, he said, "This is a land with two races of beings, man and beaver." And then he goes on to describe how beavers were in control of the waterways throughout the lowlands. And he describes how they even take perennial streams and they turn them into streams that flow year round, and they dig out ponds. And it's clear he's really paying attention to what's going on. And then he describes the uplands as peopled, and this picture of, you know, beavers are wielding an element, they're wielding water to predictably over time create the habitat that they need to live, and then people were wielding fire in much the same way in the uplands to predictably over time create habitat that humans valued. And the key thing is that those two species that were wielding their respective elements were doing it the same way for a really long time. And so everything else then got used to that. And I think that's kind of I think that's where, you know, there's an interesting conversation around fire and our forests in southwestern Oregon, Northern California, where there's another ecosystem engineer that hasn't been allowed to burn like the burning has happened, you know, for a really long time. And some of that's coming back. I know the Yurok are really leading that. But yeah, having a little bit of humility and deference to complex, old, evolved interactions, I think, is kind of where I'm settling.
Talk a little bit about, it may not be, I think a lot about shifting baselines and how, like, I read in a book many years ago that if you were in Northern California and near a waterway, you would probably see a grizzly bear every 15 minutes. So you would see 4 grizzly bears an hour. It was just, and that's, you know, there hasn't been a grizzly bear in California in what, 100 years. And can you give us a taste of what it might have been like 500 years ago? In some parts of North America, in terms of beaver management, beaver fecundity, beaver existence, whatever word you want to use. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Totally. I think, you know, people ask, like, if you had a time machine, when would you go back? And I think I would go back to where I live 300, 400 years ago, because that's such a fascinating question. So I'm 32, and just in my short life, the baseline has shifted out from under me in this landscape I live in. I live in a right up against the Siskiyou Mountains on the border of Oregon and California. And the valley, the Applegate, was called the Spink by the Takelma people who lived here, which meant place of the beaver. And this is not a place you'd ever call place of the beaver. Now we have kind of the typical narrow valleys with, a river or creek running down the center or the side of them. And we've got some beaver, you know, they live in bank dens on the main stem river. By no means would you name it that now. However, you read the old trapper journals and they talk about getting, you know, they would spend days sometimes trying to find a beaver dam to cross the valley with, because these valleys, the area that was flat was all wetland, you know, so you get to the bottom of the toe slope and you'd be presented with a wetland. And yet some of the beaver dams were so big, you could, if you brushed them out, you know, you could drive a team of horses over with a wagon because these things had been in the landscape so long. And the first white folks that came through this area were beaver trappers. They were on this mission to create a fur desert. It was kind of a geopolitical project of the Hudson Bay Company, and they were trapping every fur bearer between the Snake River and the Oregon coast. And, you know, so they came through this valley on that mission. The next white folks to come through were the gold miners, and they turned our valley upside down. And there's lots of creeks that, you know, are called, oh, Million Dollar Mile. And because there were so many gold nuggets in the stream. And the interesting thing there is, you know, when you're mining for gold, you build a sluice box, right? And you run the muddy water through, and the gold settles out behind these little ridges because it's the heaviest thing and it washes the rest of the mud through. And if you think about it, that's what beaver dams have been doing in this valley for millions of years, if not thousands, if not millions. So you had gold nuggets settling out behind beaver dams for so long that then this valley was full of that type of wealth when folks showed up who valued it. And that really speaks, I think, to the process that used to be here that isn't any longer in place. And just in my lifetime, you know, I grew up on this creek that we would go play with the dead salmon carcasses as kids. And we would swim in the creek all summer long. And I remember like dragging our feet going across the hay pasture to be really hot, you know, by the time you get to the creek, cause it was so cold. And I have three kids and they play with dry rocks in that creek now in the summertime. It doesn't flow year round anymore. And they haven't seen a salmon in there. I was trying to describe crawdads to my daughter recently, and she's looking at me like I'm just pulling her leg. She's like, mini lobsters in the creek? No way. And that's when I realized we don't have crawdads anymore. So yeah, the shift has been dramatic in that horizon of, you know, 300 years, but just in the last 20 years, you know, what I've noticed has been pretty breathtaking too.
I'm going to go a slightly different direction. And I saw a news article the other day about how they had dated some beaver dam somewhere, and it was like 500 years old or something. Do you know more about that than I do?
I don't know that story, but I do know that they can be in the landscape a really long time. I've walked a stream where I'm pretty sure I was seeing what you could classify as fossilized beaver dams in and amongst an active beaver colony. It was this stream outside Logan, Utah called Spawn Creek. And very steep stream. You know, people talk about beavers being preferring the low gradient systems, and they do, but this had a huge aspen grove on it that had been there a really long time. And so there was this beaver colony that had been there a really long time too, because beaver love aspen. And walking through this section of stream, you had the contemporary beaver dams, but then you had these like calcium ridges that the water was cascading off of too. And the hypothesis that was put forward by some of the local professors we were walking with was that that's where the calcium precipitated out over the sticks of a beaver dam. And we were, you know, more or less looking at a history of beavers on that landscape for long enough that you have fossilized beaver dams. So I think it's kind of like whales. You know, we don't know how old whales get because we killed all the old ones. And now we're just starting to realize that it's a lot older than we thought. I think that relationship to buy beavers with beavers to a specific place was an old one.
So is it conceivable that you could have, this is where I'm leading to with this, is it conceivable that you could have one family of beavers who live in basically the same home for, you know, hundreds of years then?
Yeah, one lineage. They mate for life, and they're kind of like wolves where the young ones stick around for a number of years. So they have these really tight families. And eventually the young ones go out into the landscape and disperse. And, you know, we don't even really know all that much about that process. Like, we don't know if they find a mate first and then go try to find a new territory, or if they find a new territory and then try to call in a mate. You know, it's kind of amazing how little we actually know about just basic natural history for beavers. But these territories that are set up, where you have a mom and a dad and all their young, those persist for a long time. There's no reason they wouldn't. All the species that those beavers are eating have co-evolved with beavers and are coppicing. So, like, if you look at our landscape and you look at the trees that bounce back after being knocked down, it's those trees that were down near beavers and learned to bounce back after being cut by beavers. And it was those trees that were up in the forest, the hardwoods like the madrone and the oak, that were being burned and bouncing back from that. And so it's kind of cool. You see coppicing in two different places in the landscape. And so, you know, there's this notion of, like, wouldn't the beavers run out of food? But I've never seen a site where that would be applicable, because there's just so much ecological wealth that follows when the beavers get that much water out across the landscape. And their density does seem to be dependent upon food availability. So as these sites become richer and richer, you see colonies getting closer and closer together. We don't fully understand, you know, we understand the beavers are territorial, but I think the relationships between those various territories are more complicated than we can detect. And I think you could have one lineage of beaver in a site for a really long time. Absolutely. So, and that's probably what we had across the entire Northern Hemisphere. But even here, just very recently, the biologists like myself run these models that are habitat suitability models. And we're looking for, you know, where are the low hanging fruit to try to bring beaver back? And we put all these various kind of weighted metrics into these models, like, you know, what's the gradient of the stream and what's the valley width? And it's all based on these observations of where we see beavers like to hang out. But I think it's important to remember, like, we're looking at where the beavers are choosing to hang out in a landscape that has been denuded of beavers. You know, it's kind of like we went into a war-torn country and then we developed a model around where people like to live based on where the refugee camps are. And so we make pronouncements around, you know, beavers like this kind of habitat and they don't like this kind of habitat. But I think we just don't know what that landscape looks like when beavers are in every waterway.
So you've mentioned a few times that the beavers alter the landscape and they, you know, create wetlands. And you've talked about a little bit about their relationship to biodiversity. Can you, for someone who may live in a city and may not, I mean, can you give us the ABCs of that? Just the very basics of how beavers, of the magic that beavers do for a landscape.
Yeah. So beavers, if you're a beaver, you're between 40 and 60 pounds of really tasty protein to a lot of the area's predators. And although beavers are very graceful and quick in the water, they're pretty slow moving and easy to catch on land. And so beavers have developed this trade of building dams in small and medium sized creeks to basically back up water and flood the landscape so that they're safe from predators. You know, big kitties don't like to swim, and they're predators historically, you know, when we had the grizzly bears, would have been the grizzly bears. There's still the black bears and cougars. You know, the kits are predated by a lot of the smaller predators too. And of course, wolves would have gone after beavers a lot. And so a lot of what we see beavers doing on the landscape is based on that avoiding predators. And so they build dams, and those dams both retain water, but they also retain sediment, which is a really interesting and key piece. So you'll start getting the bed of the stream will start raising up behind a beaver dam as, you know, winter floods come through and deposit kind of the murky sediment laden water slows down enough for that sand to drop out. And you get these kind of fertile pockets of soil behind beaver dams. And that's kind of what I alluded to with the gold settling out. But you start seeing that across the landscape. So we, especially now where we have these waterways that have become streams, and streams of water, you know, expeditiously rushing to the ocean, the waterways have collapsed. And often you stand on the bank and you look down into a waterway now. And I would suggest like a bank and is even just not the way you would have thought about these things not that long ago, because when beavers come in and they build these dams, they start pushing the water out onto the flat areas on either side of the stream. And then rather than your stream just being like this water course, it becomes this necklace of beaver ponds. And so there's that, there's the dam, and then they live in a lodge. And that lodge can either be kind of a freestanding structure made out of sticks that's built up out of their wetland, or they'll dig up into a bank somewhere. They like to choose kind of under big deciduous trees, and they'll get up in the root system and build out a little den there. And while they still have their, you know, your earlier question to could a beaver live in the same place for a long time? The same place, yes. The den, they often shift those dens around. So sometimes they'll be in a den or a lodge for a really long time, and sometimes they'll be building another one, you know, every couple of years. So you really only see those classic lodges emerging from the waterways in systems where there's not a convenient dry bank. Otherwise, beavers are lazy. They'll dig up into a convenient dry bank and build a little burrow there. And I've crawled up into one of those. They're very cozy. They're just kind of a big room, maybe 6 feet wide, and you know, some willow laid down on the ground, and you know, smell good. Despite the fact that Oregon has classified them legally as a predator for many, many years, they're little vegetarian, vegan mammals. So yeah, that's kind of the basic. You've got dams scattered across the landscape. It's backing up water over the entrance of their den that goes up into a lodge or a bank den. And that's kind of their front door. They care a lot about that water being backed up over their entrance of their den so that big predators don't come in. And they've developed this ability to build really strong roofs with this whole thatch of sticks, again, to try to keep predators from digging in on them. So, and you see that in remote wild places, but you know, the folks who live in cities in the Northern Hemisphere probably have beavers in their cities too. I do a lot of work, you know, in big municipal areas like Portland, and you have beavers living right in conjunction with big box stores and subdivisions, and they don't seem to take too much offense to, you know, their loud, stinky neighbors. However, it is interesting. So beavers, a lot of the early trapping journals talk about beavers being out in the daytime. And now we've classified them as a diurnal species or nocturnal. I'm sorry, nocturnal or crepuscular, which means like day and night, but evening and morning, but not diurnal, not out in the day. So there's an interesting thing there where folks who were first coming through and starting the trapping were noticing beavers all day. And now we see them in the night. And when you shine a flashlight at a beaver's eyes, they don't have the reflecting membrane like a deer would have, where you get eye shine back. So that suggests an evolutionary past that didn't involve a lot of nighttime work. It suggests that, beavers are probably working in the night now because of the predation pressure that people have brought to bear. And so they're really adaptable. And if that hypothesis is true, the beavers that were out during the day were getting trapped, and those who survived moved into the night. And so now they're kind of bumbling around with pretty poor eyesight for nighttime work. And you kind of see that borne out too in zoo populations or in urban populations where you don't have the human predation pressure. And after a few generations, the beavers get comfortable and you'll start seeing them out in the day again.
So when I think of dams, I think of how destructive they are to salmon and to anadromous fish in general and to fish in general and to the rivers. I'm talking about concrete dams and or earthen dams or whatever.
Yeah.
But beaver dams create some of the most biodiverse habitat in the world. How? Two questions. One is, why are beaver dams so incredibly biodiverse? And second is, how do fish pass dams, both tiny fish on the way down and big fish on the way back up?
Well, for a long time, we thought, I'll take your second question first, and then we'll move into biodiversity. For a long time, we thought fish couldn't pass beaver dams. And so we dynamite beaver dams when the fish runs were happening, in the name of helping the fish along.
And okay, stop. That is exactly what we were talking about early on with restoration efforts failing. Because
exactly.
That is how the people who are blowing them up, did they stop and think for 1 second, how did salmon and beaver survive for a million years?
Well, there's a pithy bumper sticker that you'll sometimes see when a bunch of nerdy biologists get together that says beaver taught salmon to jump. And yeah, stop to consider that thousands of years of relationship. I use the past tense here because we've gotten over it, but there's still a lot of places in the Northern Hemisphere where people are still ripping out beaver dams in the name of fish passage. And I've had those conversations, and it's it's a different way of seeing the world. Maybe more of the humans have to be in charge of all the aspects. There is, if you're gonna approach it and kind of steel man the argument, in a very, very degraded system, so a place where the stream has collapsed from a wide waterway that covers much of the valley down into this ditch, and then a beaver comes in for the first time in 150 years and builds a dam in that ditch, well, then the dam's going to be pretty tall before it can get the water out onto the valley. And so in that case, maybe you have an 8-foot tall beaver dam. And so during some times of the year, fish may not be able to go past it, especially if the water is scarce and the beavers are really diligent about caulking their dam with fresh mud every morning. But back to your point, these two species have a really long relationship. And whenever you go survey for juvenile fish, if you have a beaver dam anywhere in the area, that's where you're going to find the juvenile fish. And often they will be in the dam itself, because the dam is full of all these interstitial spaces, and all the bugs are there too. In fact, another thing you hear people say is like, well, beaver dams are all well and good. We get how those create habitat, but what about the beavers in the river? They're not doing much. They're rodents living in the bank. And I think the piece that is missed there is that beavers are also moving literally tons of vegetation out of the riparian area and into the stream. And that's driving the entire bottom of the food web. And so you've got, the nerdy term for that is allochthonous inputs. You've got beavers driving the chain that then creates these tangles of beaver sticks that you can snorkel up to, and that looks like snorkeling up to a reef. I've heard people call them river reefs because all the fish and all the bugs are there in this tangle of beaver sticks. And so I think beavers are manipulating plants and they're manipulating water. And by doing that, the habitat flows from those two things. And if you're trying to get beavers into an area, that's what you need to look at too, is there enough water and can the plants take root? So Yeah, I don't know. People are tricky. I was recently in Europe, and they're welcoming beaver back into landscapes where beaver have been gone for 400 plus years. And some of the most ardent critics are the fishermen. In Narnia, unfortunately, C.S. Lewis has beavers serving fish. And that's kind of like the Little Red Riding story of the beaver world, and that a lot of people then are under the impression that beavers eat fish. Even though in Narnia, you know, the beaver is also serving beer, and nobody's criticizing beavers for being alcoholic. I don't know if it's fully that, but I think the interesting thing there is we were, you know, we talk about shifting baselines, right? And we talk about what was it like 500 years ago or 1500 years ago. Humans were here for that. I mean, that's the interesting thing. Like we were there when beavers were in charge of all the waterways in Europe and in North America. And there was an evolved, complex relationship that we've forgotten. You know, we used to go to beaver wetlands in recognition that that's where the ecological wealth was. You know, if you're looking to harvest protein to feed yourself, you're going to a beaver wetland because that is where the ecological wealth is. And there was an evolved relationship with humans and beavers that I think we've lost sight of. You can see little tendrils of it. For instance, there's an early written law in Iran where there's this massive penalty if you kill a water dog, which is what they call beavers. It explains that if you kill a water dog, a drought will follow. And this is the reason for the law. And here's the penalty. And it involved a big fine. And you had to kill a lot of snakes. There's ecological wisdom. People a long time ago recognized you take the beavers off the landscape and drought will follow. And yet somehow we've lost sight of that. And there's others who have looked at in North America, you know, when the white folks came over, and started beaver trapping, generally those indigenous tribes who were in drought prone areas were very adverse to getting on the trapping train. And it was only those tribes who were in really water rich areas or forest dwelling areas that could be convinced, to go for the trinkets and start turning in beaver pelts. So we used to know this, and we've just kind of lost sight of it. I mean, beavers drove Western expansion throughout our continent. The pilgrims were financing their settlement on beaver hides, and our country was founded on that wealth, the beaver furs moving back to Europe. And so for a long time, they were like one of the original natural resources to be extracted from the landscape. And then they've been kind of relegated to pest species for the last 100 years. And, I think people are starting to see them again as a quote unquote natural resource, but perhaps one to be like valued and cherished and encouraged on the land, in the land.
So thank you for all this wonderful introduction to beavers themselves. And we have, I don't know, 7 or 8 minutes left. Can you talk a while about Project Beaver itself? Well, first off, is there anything else you want to say about beavers themselves? And then can you talk about Project Beaver?
Yeah. I think the final thing I would say about beavers is chances are, depending on where you're listening, you probably have beavers close to where you live. And my plug would be go find the beavers in your area. They're one of the only wildlife, you know, like you can't go spot a wolverine very easily, but if you go sit quietly on the edge of a beaver wetland, you can see a beaver, and they're really cool. And I think, they're pretty easy to find too. You can start walking streams and just, they leave a cast of sticks all over wherever they've been. So you'll start noticing the chewed branches, and, if they're fresh, if they're golden in color, there's probably a good chance that there's a beaver there. And I would just encourage folks to go start exploring, because beavers are in urban areas. Beavers are in our most rural areas, and they're often kind of quietly unnoticed. Yeah, transitioning to Project Beaver. So we there's a lot of groups that are starting to help try to bring beavers back into the landscape. And a lot of these groups are place-based. They're working in a specific geography or a specific watershed. I think the niche that we've kind of identified where I think we can be really helpful is in service of those groups, kind of addressing the tricky issues that humans stumble on when they're trying to bring beavers back into an area. And so I spend a lot of my time helping folks with coexisting with beavers. And there's a number of different devices you can build to trick beavers out of not plugging a culvert or to kind of set a do not exceed line on a beaver dam that happens to be very close to somebody's house. And, you know, they don't want their basement to flood. And so with Project Beaver, we're really focused on tools and trying to improve and develop tools that help facilitate that relationship. And then also making available the tools where people can realize the wealth that beavers are bringing back to the landscape too. I think, like I said, humans have sort of forgotten what ecological wealth looks like. And we're also a storytelling species. And so I really appreciate the ability to come on a podcast like this. And I think that's, you know, something that we're looking at as well is how can we help get the word out around this relationship that we've perhaps forgotten, but we used to know very well. And what are the tools? You know, often a farmer will be farming a big piece of land and it's probably fertile because it used to be beaver wetlands and it's also flat. And so then, you know, a beaver moves in and floods 4 or 5 acres of land. And it's all fine and dandy for us as society to say, now we've decided we want beavers in the landscape. But if that farmer is losing out on 3 or 4 acres of the land that they're paying their mortgage payment with, there's currently no support for that. And so I think one of the big things that we're going to be focusing on too is how can we help those humans who have stewardship over a landscape realize the value that beavers are bringing to that. So that, you know, if you're a farmer and a beaver floods an acre of land, you can make a decision. Well, do I want to let the beavers be my new crop manager and see that as a resource to how I'm running my farm, or do I want to remove the beavers and go back to whatever I've been farming before? So I think that is kind of a roundabout way, but I think there's a lot of really interesting things to try to help shift our relationship a little bit. This is kind of one of those things that we can wrap our head around when we're, you know, we talk about this shifting baseline and the fact that my creek is now dry every summer. You know, this is one of those things where we know it works. We know if we defer to this humble rodent in managing our wetlands or our waterways, we're going to have wetlands that have more biodiversity, that have huge carbon storage, that have excellent fish habitat, that sequester wildfires. And we've got the science that backs up every one of those statements. And now it's just kind of the tricky problem of figuring out how to make it work for the people. So that's what we're working on.
So I guess I have two questions left. One of them is, so if somebody wants to find out more about your organization and or help out in some way, can you give a website? Can you talk about how they can, apart from going and looking at beavers, what can they do either to help you or to help beavers? First question is that.
Yeah. So we have a website. It's projectbeaver.org. If you Google Project Beaver, it should come up too. And yeah, drop us a line there. You can kind of see what we're up to. We're in the process of revising that now, so it should be ever more useful, hopefully. We're a 501c3, so folks can support us through donation there too. And if something that we're doing looks like something that you have the skill set to help with, be sure to reach out around that as well. Because it's been a delight. There's been folks who are really competent professionals in their various fields who have reached out and volunteered to help us, you know, doing things that they otherwise get paid a lot of dollars per hour to do. And that's grand fun too. So if you want to reach out to help volunteer or support us with funding, that's the spotprojectbeaver.org.
So I guess now I have two questions. So I lied. So I had three. So the next one is, one of the articles is beavers for the butterflies at Vesper Meadow. Can you talk for a moment about how beavers help insects of one sort or another?
Yeah. So back to long, complex relationship, right? You have when beavers back up water and they turn this collapsed stream into a saturated sponge, the plant life changes, but then you can watch the insect biomass just spike. And with that, then the beavers are usually flooding out trees that then turn into snags that then bats move into. And it's pretty remarkable. You can watch the whole ecosystem kind of come back to life. Vesper Meadow is a meadow near where we're at, and it was a traditional camas food meadow for the folks who have been here a really long time, and most recently was a pretty heavily grazed cattle pasture. And so we're working with the group that's up there now trying to restore it, both to bring the camas back and then bring the butterflies back that are reliant on the flowers like the camas. So yeah, it's kind of one of those things you can point to whatever you want to point to, because beavers were managing waterways and everything, because water was life and everything relies on water. You can point to the biomass of insects, you can point to the flowers, but if it has wetlands or water in its life cycle, it's going to do well in a beavered landscape.
So my last question has to do with exactly what you're talking about, that I love these surprising relationships. And I'm going to describe what I mean by that. And so I want you, in the meantime, thinking about the most surprising relationship between beavers and something. And an example of this is, when wolves came back into Yellowstone, they improved fish habitats. Like, what? And that's because they chased the herbivores were getting really lazy, like the elk and the deer were getting really lazy and just sitting next to the stream side all the time. And they were harming the streams by having too many of them there. And so the wolves come in, they start chasing the elk and deer around, and the stream side recovers. So it helps trout. So wolves lead to trout, which is just it's not something you'd expect. And, there are relationships between, like, I was talking to George Wertner a few years ago about how he loved going up and seeing grizzly bears eating ants who were living in the trees killed in the fire in Yellowstone 30 years ago. So the fire 30 years ago is leading to a bumper crop of food for grizzly bears. I love, you see what I'm getting at, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So what's just a weird, fun thing to end with more beavers lead to something nobody would guess?
Well, your two examples have me thinking of two things. So the one with fires, something I've noticed, we had a pretty catastrophic fire through some riparian areas a couple of years ago. And it was a fantastic reset to bring beavers back in, because you had all these conifers die and fall in the stream, and the stream that was like a bowling alley suddenly has all this tangle of wood in it, and it's slowing down enough for the beavers to actually build a dam that'll persist. And then all the kind of old deciduous trees that are not so great as if you're looking at them as a food were suddenly all these young resprouting fresh shoots. And so it was something we looked at as like, oh, this was a catastrophic wildfire. But no, in fact, it was the seed of bringing back in that natural process of beavers. So anyway, that's not quite your question, but I would point out the example you give. Beavers are the missing piece in how you describe that story. So the elk were overeating the willow and creating this denuded riparian area. But when the elk were then chased away and had to start acting like herd animals and elk again, the beavers moved back. And then the beavers started harvesting all this willow that they otherwise couldn't get at and building dams. And so the trout habitat that resulted was the result of beavers. And so wolves are good for beavers, which is funny because, you know, wolves eat beavers. But yeah, so I would insert beavers into your story there as a good example of kind of the humble work that they do.
Well, that's great. And thank you so much for your work in the world. And thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Jacob Shockey. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.